It's good to see that so many people in Bloomsburg are interested in your physics. I hope that's not why you're here, that's not the number of my brother I'm going to talk about. A lot of people come to my lecture a little bit curious. They think that the title like Mythbusters are real and I'm really a nuclear physicist, which I am. But it's really a comment. That is, I'm going to say flying saucers are real and hallucinations, or flying saucers are real in which you expect to find the restaurant and the waitresses I interview, or some such nonsense. Let me clear up many of those concerns about what I mean and what I'm saying. I'll put my punchline right at the beginning. There'll be no question as to where I sit. After 15 years of studied investigation, I'm convinced that evidence is overwhelming that planet Earth is being visited by intelligently controlled extraterrestrial vehicles, that is, vehicles from off the Earth. In other words, some UFOs are somebody else's spacecraft. Now, that certainly doesn't mean that I know where they come from, how they operate, or why they don't talk to me, or what they want here, any of those things. It means that the evidence is overwhelming. Now, the form of the evidence is kind of a pain in the neck for a physicist. It would be nice if I had a flying saucer, I could land on the front lawn and show it to you, and everybody would believe that they were real. And it would be a heck of a lot easier way of getting here than the way I came today. I don't have a flying saucer. I don't even have a piece of something I can hold up for you and say, I've analyzed this with all the latest instrumentation and it's one-third unobtainium and two-thirds element 126 that we didn't even know existed. And that proves it's part of somebody's spaceship. No piece to show you. I haven't even arranged for an appropriate moment in my talk for a little green man to come trotting out and by so I can point to him and say, see, he proves they're good. What we have to do, for the most part, is make do with citing reports. That is to say, eyewitness testimony from responsible, respectable people from all over the world. We will carefully ignore the eyewitness testimony from the unresponsible, unrespectable people. There are also landing cases. I'll talk about those. There are creature reports. There are radar bases. There are photographs. But the heart of the matter are the UFO sighting reports. Things that people have seen that they've told somebody about. If they've seen it and haven't told anybody about it, they're not part of the data they've built. Now, there are three categories of UFO sighting reports. It's very important to distinguish amongst these three groups, otherwise we have total confusion. Now, the largest category, category one, includes those reports by confident or incompetent observers of strange phenomena in the sky or on the ground, which the observer cannot identify, but which can be identified by competent investigators spending enough time, money, and effort. Now, these are the only sightings that the skeptics talk about. But let's face it, these are IFOs, identifiable flying objects. Once a sighting has been identified, it's irrelevant to the search for truth about unidentifiable flying objects. So for the rest of my lecture, having acknowledged that there is this big pile of IFOs, let's forget them. They're useless for what we're trying to do, that is find out what UFOs are. The same can be said about the second category of reports. It includes those reports for which not enough information is obtained for a competent investigator to reach some sort of conclusion as to what was observed. You can study these not enough data cases for 5 or 10 years, you won't find out anything about UFOs. So it leaves us only with the third category of reports on which to base any conclusion. This one includes those reports by competent observers of strange phenomena in the sky or on the ground which the observer cannot identify and which remain unidentified after investigation by competent investigators and which furthermore we judge to have been manufactured on the basis of the way they look and to have been manufactured off the earth on the basis of the way they behave. Now there's a lot of kickers on that last category. The skeptics at this point, and I suppose in an audience this size, there might be 7 or 8 skeptics anyway. The skeptics would say, hey, with that last definition, he just steal the rest of his talk. Now come the funny stories, because everybody knows there aren't any insights by competent observers that can't be identified by a competent investigator, especially none that give any indication of being somebody else's spacecraft. Right? Wrong. Totally, completely, absolutely, definitely false, that notion. A major point that I'd like to make tonight is that every large-scale scientific study of UFOs, and I'll talk about five of them, has produced a substantial number of Category 3 reports. That is, competent observer, competent investigator, plenty of data, and every indication that we are dealing with intelligently controlled extraterrestrial vehicles. The problem, of course, is that most people, especially skeptics, are completely unfamiliar with these large-scale studies. So I'd like to spend the first part of my lecture dealing with the data. One of my biases as a scientist is that if one is going to have an opinion about something controversial, it ought to be based on a study of the data. That's my own peculiar viewpoint. It's not a very popular one, but it's mine. Now, the largest comprehensive scientific study of UFOs ever conducted was not the University of Colorado study, the so-called Condon Reader, completed about 5 years ago. We'll talk about that one too. Rather, it was one completed way back in 1955. It was done at the Battelle Memorial Institute in Columbus, Ohio. BMI is a very well-respected research and development firm, best known, I guess, for developing the Xerox process. No, I mean Xerox machines, they developed the process. They were under contract to the Air Force Group concerned with UFOs. Dr. Klubler, located right at Patterson Air Force Base, just outside Dayton, Ohio, not far from Columbus, which is one of the reasons they were involved. Anyway, it was BMI's job to look at all the sightings in the Air Force files from the period 1947 through 1952, and then some thereafter. Well over 2,000 sighting reports were examined. Every sighting was eventually categorized as something or other. You know, aircraft, balloon, astronomical, six different categories. Every sighting was also eventually evaluated as to quality. Now, presumably a report from a pilot, a physicist, and a priest of something observed 50 yards away for half an hour in broad daylight would be considered a somewhat higher quality report than one of the lights zipping by in the sky observed for 3 seconds at 4 o'clock in the morning by a drunken bum. It's a subjective evaluation, but it's a meaningful one. Anyhow, they had all kinds of data about every sighting. You know, apparent size, color, shape, speed, latitude, longitude, angle of the sun, all kinds of stuff. They put all this stuff together with the categorizations and the quality evaluations in a great big fat report, Project Blue Book, Special Report number 14. Now, the report itself was never publicly distributed, although, interestingly enough, it wasn't classified either. What was given wide distribution at that time is a three-part package. A press release, which tended to set the tone for what people thought about UFOs for the next 15 or 20 years. A supposed summary of this biggest of all studies. I say supposed because somehow it manages not to have one piece of data from the report itself. I call it a summary, I don't know, but they did. And finally, a drawing by an Air Force artist. Now, the whole thrust of this three-part package was that we just did this big study, and nothing to fly in saucers, but soon we will be building a strange-looking round craft, and if you see one, say one that looks like this drawing, don't worry about it, it's ours. Manned by good things. Let's turn the projector on and the lights down. We'll talk about this biggest of all studies of UFOs. That's the cover of a privately published version. That's the drawing I was talking about. That's really the Canadian-American Avro car. It did get built, it got 3 feet off the ground, and then after spending $10 million, they canceled the program because it allows a year for them. A word about the title here, Project Blue Book Special Report number 14. Now, you don't just pull a number out of the air and, you know, call it Blue Book Special Report 14. Interestingly enough, the press release did not contain the name of the report, it didn't contain the names of the people who did the work, and it didn't contain the location where the work was done. And amazingly enough, nobody can. That's what's really key. Because there is significance to the title. Reports 1 through 12, all were classified, either secret or confidential. Every once in a while, somebody will try to tell you that nothing's been classified about UFOs. It's hogwash. The original reports still have the original security classification data on them and the declassification data. You can't declassify something that wasn't classified in the first place. 13 is the intriguing one. The three different stories there. Some people say, well, the Air Force was superstitious. They didn't put out a Blue Book Report 13. I find that very hard to believe in myself. If you write the Air Force, they will tell you, well, 13 was written, but it was included in 14. Having read 1 through 12, 14, and the Patel Memorial Institute progress reports during this time, I don't believe that either. There's not one indication of that. Finally, I met a former Air Force man who said that at a SAC base, he saw a copy in the classified file of Blue Book Report 13. It was still marked top secret 2.5 years ago. That one, I believe. If the Daniel Ellsberg in the UFO world is out there someplace, I'd very much like a copy of Blue Book Report 13. No questions asked. All right, let me tell you what the public was told about this study. It's in the press release. There was a statement by the man who was then the Secretary of the Air Force, Donald Quarles. It's October 25th, I guess it was, 1955. In the following statement, quote, on the basis of this study, we believe that no objects such as those properly described flying saucers have overflown the United States. I feel certain that even the unknown 3% could have been explained as conventional phenomena or illusions if more complete observational data had been available. Unquote. There are apparently two factual statements there, which taken together throw out my third category of reports. That is, the unknown's only number 3%. And that's just because there wasn't enough data. There were really category 2 sightings. And the public was told, it was headlines around the country, editorials here and there, set the tone. One minor detail wrong with those two supposedly factual statements is that they're both completely false. Why do I say that? Let's look at the next slide and you'll see them. This is a categorization of 2,199 studies. The first three categories, astronomical, aircraft, balloon, are pretty obvious. And I read them not because I don't think you can read, but for those people who think reporters, they can't see these categories. Other is really miscellaneous. It includes all kinds of stuff. But searchlights on clouds, foxes, birds, hoaxes. You name it, somebody's reported it one time. And yes, it also includes the crack pipe cases. Are there crack pipes associated with UFOs? Of course there are. Of the 2,199 sightings, 2%, 2, not 20, not 80, 2% were eventually labeled very likely as psychological aberrations. You can call them crack pipes. I better add, as a member of the American Physical Society, that the APS says that of the thousands of papers submitted to it for publication, 2% are crack pipe papers. Are there crackpots associated with physics? Of course there are. About the same percentage is associated with UFOs. I'm the only one with a foot in both camps at the present, but we're trying to change that. Okay, now the thing that you're interested in are the unknowns. You'll notice that there are 434 unknowns. If you divide by 2,199 sightings and believe the Secretary of the Air Force, this number ought to be 3%. Quite obviously it isn't. It's 19.7%. That's only 6 times, 6.5 times as high a percentage of unknowns as the public was told by the Secretary of the Air Force and the major newspapers in the country. Obviously, the Secretary of the Air Force wasn't very good at arithmetic. Equally strange is the fact that there is this last category here, insufficient information. It's made crystal clear in this report that if there wasn't enough data available about the sightings, the vital piece of information was missing. It absolutely could not be labeled unknown. It had to be labeled appropriately enough as insufficient information. In complete contrast to the statement of the Secretary of the Air Force, who said even the unknowns could have been identified before data had been available. There wasn't enough data, absolutely not enough. So we weren't told the truth about that in this season. Now the skeptic at this point would say, hey, wait a minute, those are interesting numbers, but you said they did a quality evaluation of all these sites. How do we know that those unknowns aren't just the drunken phone cases? Perfectly legitimate question, you don't know. So let's look at the next slide, which is the quality evaluation information. Look at the top line, the excellent sightings. Fewer than 10% were labeled excellent. This means they had tight criteria. Look at the last column. 33.3%, one-third of the excellent sightings were labeled unknown. One-quarter of the good sightings, and one-sixth of the doubtful and poor sightings. In other words, the better the quality of the sighting, the more likely it was to be labeled unknown. Exactly the opposite of what skeptics about to tell us. This is, on the other hand, precisely what one would expect if. It's a very big if. The unknowns were really something different. But you see, that raises the $64,000 question. If the unknowns weren't aircraft, and they weren't balloons, and they weren't astronomical, and they weren't miscellaneous, and they weren't the ones for which there wasn't enough data, what out of this world were they? And you say, how in the heck did you get out of this world from just a bunch of numbers? I did it. Let's turn the lights back on. You'll see why I say these data lead one to believe that some UFOs are indeed from out of this world, or from off this planet. It's really a combination of two things taken together. That is, the physical appearance of the objects that were reported and how they were observed to behave, how they moved around in the sky. Let me stress at this point that we're dealing here strictly with unknowns. Forget all the things that turned out to be Venus or Jupiter or hoaxes or helicopters or balloons or all those other things. We've brushed them aside. Just the unknowns. If you want to be very fastidious, the excellent unknowns. Okay, what they look like. Typically, we're dealing with round, metallic, disc-shaped objects, symmetric this way, definite size, shape, often surface texture, sometimes protuberances that might be interpreted to be landing gear or antenna or windows. It might be decorations, too. We really don't know. Size ranging from, a few feet in diameter up to a couple hundred feet in diameter. Bigger in diameter this way than in thickness this way. The classical flying saucer. Smaller number of reports of a cigar-shaped object. An even smaller number of reports of a huge, hundreds of feet long, cigar-shaped mothership often involved. Simply because little discs go in and out of the big mothership. Now, what I've described so far, obviously, is insufficient basis for saying these things come from off the Earth. Obviously, there are 50 different companies on the surface of planet Earth that could build things that look as I described. Meaning 1,000 McDonnell Douglas, Boeing, Lockheed, those lock them right up. It's when you get into the picture, however, how these things are observed to behave, that one says, they weren't manufactured here. How did they behave? Well, typically, if non-metallic, disc-shaped objects were able to hover, sit still in the sky, move straight up, straight down, move forward, and then back, without circling around, move at extremely high speeds horizontally, say 10,000 miles an hour, as observed on radar, make almost right angle turns at high speeds. One Navy man told me how he watched on the radar scope while his buddy was up on the deck watching the object turn on the intercom. Five right angle turns in a row at 2,500 miles an hour. They entered into the ship's log. The captain was up for promotion. He took it out of the ship's log. That's the ship. Okay, now, this strange flight behavior, typically without any exhaust, without much noise, without any visible external engines, without any wings, without a tail, without any red green lights, often with a glow in the region immediately adjacent to the craft. And I submit to you that in 1955, there wasn't anybody on the surface of planet Earth who could in quantity. People often reported flocks of UFOs, 5, 10, 15, 20 of them. Nobody on the surface of planet Earth who could in quantity build things that look as I describe and acted as I describe. And we therefore deduce if they weren't made here, they were made someplace else. It doesn't tell us where, how, why, any of those other things. It just says, not manufactured here. Where do I think they're from? From some other solar system. I'll name a particular one in a little while. There's no reason to assume they're all from the same place either. Now back to this study. The guys who did this effort were competent professional people spending full time. It wasn't a committee at all meeting for 3 days and solving the problem. They asked an obvious question, just got to think about it. They had all kinds of data about every study. They said, is there really any difference between the unknowns and the knowns? Maybe on the average, these two groups are alike, but we just missed the boat in this screening process. They did a chi-square statistical analysis. Unknowns versus knowns, six different characteristics, things like color, size, shape, speed, that sort of thing. I won't go into the details of that, they're really important. The results are worth mentioning, though, and that is that the probability that the unknowns come from the same population of sighting reports as the knowns is less than 1%. Less than 1%. That doesn't prove that they're different. It says it's very unlikely that unknowns are just misknown. Even though the skeptics will tell you all the time. The data show that that would be a false statement, that the unknowns are just misknown. There's all kinds of other useful information. There are kinds of tables and charts and graphs. For example, there's information on the duration of observation. Is how long did people watch something that they eventually reported as a UFO? Popular myth here is that UFO sightings are like automobile accidents. You know, they happen like that, and you can't really trust eyewitness reports. The facts are rather different. The average unknown was observed for considerably longer than the average known. More than 60% of the unknowns were observed for longer than 60 seconds. More than 40% were observed for longer than 5 minutes. And a substantial number were observed for longer than 30 minutes. We are not dealing here with short-term observations by incompetent observers of things seen under poor conditions. There are plenty of sightings like that. They're not the ones that concern us. Quite the contrary. We spend our effort looking at the multiple things that are long-term observations by competent observers under good circumstances. One final point from this study, and that is there is specific definite mention of radar unknowns. I don't just mean sightings on radar, which eventually got listed as any of the FNOs that is a cool star, and which the guys who did this study were completely aware of. I mean sightings that eventually got labeled by competent professional people as unknown. Typically a radar visual case that is very eyes as well as radar sense. A lot of, I stress this because a lot of people apparently believe the statement made on the CBS television special back about 8 years ago now. The one that Walter Cronkite did, supposedly on UFOs, about 95% on UFOs. Anyway, toward the end of the program, a spokesman for the North American Air Defense Command, the guy with the radar sense, stood up and said flatly, "We have never observed UFOs on radar." He was either lying or ignorant or both, because the Air Force files are loaded with radar unknowns. I'm not necessarily giving him a hard time if he was lying, because if the official classification guide says, "I'm shocked if we have seen them on radar," then he had to lie. That's the way the security game is played. I know, I worked on classified programs for 14 years. Let me give you one radar case, right out of the Air Force files. Just to give you some flavor for the sort of stuff that's around and people are looking for. This took place in the 50s. It started with an RB-47 reconnaissance bomb. Actually, it did not mean bombs. It's loaded with electronics gear. Flying across the Gulf of Mexico, heading north as it crosses over the boundary of the border of Mississippi. It's suddenly joined by a brilliantly glowing, rather large, blue object out in front of the plane. It's observed visually by the crew, six-man crew, picked up by the plane's signal receiving equipment, and later on by ground-based radar and an eyeball observer, if you will, on the ground. I say later on because the plane and the UFO together flew across Mississippi, west across Louisiana, northwest across the corner of Texas and up into Oklahoma. Total distance of 700 miles. took about an hour and a half. Now, the UFO didn't just meander along with the Earth, but every once in a while it did something a bit peculiar. For example, it would go from the 10 o'clock position, that is forward of the left wing, zip, 2 o'clock position toward the right wing. Angular velocity of the clouds is completely beyond his experience in anything he'd ever seen 20 years ago. To that point, it was observed visually, picked up by the client signal receiving equipment, confirmation ground based radar. At another point of the flight, the UFO stops dip. That's a neat trick at 500 miles an hour. Plane is closing on it at that speed, suddenly sprint down several thousand feet instantly. Observed visually by the drone, picked up by the plane signal receiving equipment. There's more to the case than this, but that's enough to give you some flavor. What would you do if you're the Air Force stuck with a case like that? Six highly trained people, the whole plane load of sophisticated electronics, ground-based confirmation. We'd probably do what they did. They classified the case, was classified for 12 years, finally declassified, published in a technical journal. That is one of dozens of radar unknowns from the Air Force fund. That's the biggest official scientific study of UFOs ever done. How many people here have read a copy of Davidson's version, let's say, of Project Blue Book Special Report 14? Would you raise your hand if you have? Would you say yes if you have? I guess we struck out. Okay, that's the oldest such study. Let's turn the lights down about halfway and we'll run through several more of these sources of information. This one is entitled, appropriately enough, the UFO Evidence. It's published by the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, NICAC is called, now headquartered here in Washington, D.C., not in it, way back in 1964. Now, NICAC has a few thousand members, many of them professional people such as myself. This document contains information on about 746 unknowns called from roughly 4,500 cases at NICAC that have been investigated. That alone will make it interesting, but in addition, it's got a whole chapter on sightings by commercial pilots, a whole chapter on sightings by military pilots, a whole chapter on sightings by scientists, engineers, astronomers, a whole chapter on sightings by law enforcement people, and a whole chapter on evidence for intelligent control. It's an excellent source of information. The only problem, of course, is that it's privately published. Most people don't even know it exists. It's available only from NICAC. Okay, that's 1964. Let's look at the next one. This one also has a limited distribution. Believe it or not, it's available only from the government. It's the Symposium on Unidentified Flying Objects. Hearings before the Committee on Science and Astronautics, U.S. House of Representatives, July 29, 1968. Kind of intriguing, if you write the Air Force for data on UFOs, I'll send you a couple of printed pages, a little list of stuff available from the government. This one is the one. Probably because it's by far the best one you can get from the government, because the data in it leads people to believe that some UFOs are somebody else's spacecraft. Now it contains, well, the hearings actually included verbal testimony from six scientists. Six more of us were asked to contribute only in writing, and the written testimony of all 12 is included in this 250-page report. I was one of the latter six in that. Now, the 12 scientists cover a broad spectrum of professional backgrounds, nuclear physics, astrophysics, astronomy, psychology, sociology, biology, civil engineering, gravitational physics. 10 out of the 12 came out fairly strongly pro-UFO. One was neutral, and one was a Harvard professor of astronomy, retired, Dr. Donald Menzel. Now, Menzel continued to maintain, as he had for the previous, 15 years at least, that there weren't any sightings that he couldn't explain. What's intriguing is the methods he used to explain the sighting. He did something nobody else does, at least not as well. He adjusts the data to match his explanation, rather than deriving his explanation from the data. For example, he liked temperature inversions. You know, when the air gets warmer, it's warm instead of colder, and that bends the rods, that sort of thing. So case after case, temperature inversion, temperature inversion. In I mean, probably when they do the calculations, you know, how much of a temperature inversion would have been required to produce that effect under the circumstances, you find typically, say, 20 or 30 degree temperature inversion would have been required. You go back to the weather records for the right place, right time of day, and you find that there's a 2 or 3 degree temperature. Let me give you a more explicit example. There's a famous case that took place in Papua New Guinea back in 1859. An Anglican minister, Reverend Gibble, his assistant, a bunch of natives, 2 nights running actually, observed a UFO sitting out on the lagoon. Second night, there were creatures around the edge of the UFO, and somebody on the ground waved, and one of the creatures waved back. It was a big night in fact, I believe. Anyway, the observation lasted for more than an hour. Reverend Gibble made copious notes, the natives made statements, the assistant made statements. And this story made its way into the UFO literature. Well, Dr. Menzel looked at the story, checked his astronomical file, and said, well, look, Venus was very bright that night. Obviously, they were observing Venus. There's a little problem for Bernard Gill, except that the thing was elliptical, you know, rather than round. And Dr. Menzel thought about that for a while, and he came up with a solution. He said, look, he obviously had a serious visual defect, astigmatism in part, and Dr. Menzel was able to show in the laboratory that with sufficiently bad lenses, you could make something that's round look elliptical. And so clearly that's what happened, and the response of the natives is, of course, because they went along with the great white father, no matter what he said. That's a rather clever explanation. It's got a few little difficulties. In the first place, there was a cloud cover that night, an overcast. No way in the world you could have seen Venus from that place at that time. And Reverend Gill had mentioned this in his description of the site. Secondly, he had fully corrective vision, was wearing his glasses at the time of the observation. And third, he and the natives had been on the outs about several other things for months, and they wouldn't believe what he said about anything that night unless they seen it themselves. So except for those minor details. Great explanation. Frankly, his approach is don't bother me with the facts, my mind's made up. That's one way to look at UFOs, but it certainly isn't a scientific. Okay, two papers in here are really worth talking about. The best by far, in my opinion, is one by the late Dr. James E. McDonough. Jim was a professor of physics at the University of Arizona, expert in the physics of the upper atmosphere, total skeptic on UFOs. He thought the Earth was in this big scientific study, I hadn't found a thing in this, so why worry about it? He was challenged, he visited NICAP, he visited Project Blue Book. He spent almost full time for almost 3 years studying UFOs, personally interviewed over 500 witnesses. And to make a long story short, he concluded that this is the most challenging scientific problem of all time, that some UFOs are extraterrestrial, and that the Air Force investigations were completely inadequate from a scientific viewpoint. And then to face up squarely to the objections raised by the uninformed skeptics, Jim gave information on 41 separate sightings, subdivided in about 7 groups. Each group set up to respond to one objection. In a compound I've never seen on radar, because you have those radar cases. Why aren't they ever seen over big cities? Pretty much a big city case. How come there's always only one witness, and that witness is a kook at that, where you define who is anybody who claims to have seen it? He gives you examples in multiple witness cases. Multiple doesn't mean 2 or 3, it means 20 or 30 witnesses. How come they're never seen by pilots, by astronomers, by meteorologists, people who worry about what's going on up there? Gives you a bunch of sightings by each of those groups. You can write any of those objections you want, but I would suggest you not reach a conclusion about them until after you've looked at the data. Then you will find that none of those objections or any others I've been able to stand up under careful scrutiny and comparison with the data. You want to ignore the data, ignore all the objections here to the point. The real world says that's not the case. Now, the other paper I want to mention here is one by Dr. J. Allen Hynek, H-Y-N-E-K. Dr. Hynek is chairman of the astronomy department at Northwestern University. For 20 years, he was the Air Force's scientific consultant on UFOs. Much better known for reasons which are obvious is Mr. Swampgate's back several years ago because of some sightings in Michigan and the explanation of Swampgate's that he gave. Anyway, the testimony to Congress, Dr. Hynek makes quite clear that he does not believe that UFOs can be swept into the swamp gas rock, or any other rock for that matter. He tries to get rid of a lot of the myths, says there's plenty of good sightings, that's been out of the job. Now, that was 1968, he's kind of stepped beyond that. Let's look at the next slide. He's written a book, The UFO Experience, A Scientific Inquiry. It's in its sixth printing now, it came out in
September 7th. Take yourself, yeah.
It's been favorably reviewed in half a dozen technical journals, which is amazing in itself. And a number of other places, ranging from the Christian Science Monitor to Playboy magazine. Sort of strange bedtime. Anyway, in this book, Dr. Hynek gives about 70 sightings from his own files, the Air Force files, all of which could be explained. Average number of witnesses, about 4 per case. He had some specific recommendations about what can you do about the UFOs. He has some strong comments about the inadequacy of the Air Force effort from a scientific viewpoint. Remember, he was on the inside for 20 years. And he also has some pretty definite comments about the inadequacy of the University of Colorado study, the so-called Condon report, which we'll talk about in a minute. I often have people ask me, you know, what's the best single book to read on the subject? At the moment, I suppose I'd say this one, at least until I get one written, and that's going to be the one. There's a new one coming out that is pretty good for people who've never read any books on UFOs. There's one, I'll wait a bit later, I don't have the slides, they just came out yesterday. Beyond Earth by Ralph Blum, a new Bantam paperback. This is an excellent book, I recommend it. Anyway, let's look at the next slide. This is the infamous, well, I prefer that term, some people say famous, the so-called scientific study of unidentified flying objects. It's usually referred to as the Condon Report, since it was done under the direction of Dr. Edward G. Condon, a world-famous physicist at the University of Colorado, where he spent $539,710 of our bucks. Now, frankly, Dr. Condon was 65 when he started this. He read this small print and said, fewer than 10% of the cases couldn't be examined. That's just because there wasn't enough data. There were a number of editorials this time, all over the country. Some of them rather nasty, saying things like, now the UFO nuts can join the members of that other crazy group, Flat Earth Society, and of course, let's do something useful. That was the tone. It was based entirely on Dr. Condon's summary and conclusions, the first 2 chapters of this study, and an Air Force press release. And the only thing wrong with that is that just as with Project Blue Book Special Report 14, what the public was told and what the report shows are exactly the opposite. If you read the rest of this book and one wonders whether Condon did have a better summary and conclusion than that, the rest, if one finds the data in it make an excellent case for some UFOs as somebody else's spacecraft. For example, there's a whole chapter on sightings by orbiting astronauts. 3 of those sightings remain unexplained to this day. I don't know about you, I happen to think an orbiting astronaut is a reasonably trustworthy, loyal, honest, confident observer. Because if he is, we have no business trusting with a few $100 million vehicle up there. You can't have it both ways. Believe everything he says, except if you see the flying saucer, then he's suffering from UFO-itis. As far as I'm concerned, that's a disease that doesn't exist. There is one that does, that's anti-UFO-itis, but we'll worry about that. Now, all kinds of good cases in the report, but don't let me give you the impression it's a great study, because it's not. The chapter on plasmas and UFOs is terrible. Many things wrong with it. There's a whole chapter on government involved in UFO investigations, and yet somehow nowhere in a 965-page book is there even a mention of the biggest study on UFOs ever done, Project Blue Book Special Report 14. Mention reports once for 12, Harvard's reports. They were all classified. The unclassified one that covered 18 times as many cases as Condon covered isn't mentioned. You may wonder, maybe Dr. Condon didn't know about it since nobody here had read it. He knew about it because I wrote him in detail about it, got a letter back from him saying, thank you for the information you sent, read it with interest, give you a reference for that study of interstellar travel on page 15, that sort of thing. He neglected that one too. I won't nitpick any longer, I really don't have time for that, technically, as we talk, but Coming to the findings of a special subcommittee on UFOs set up by the prestigious American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, the world's largest group of space scientists. An 11-man subcommittee on UFOs, some from industry, some from the government, some from universities. They intentionally excluded anybody who had expressed a pro-UFO opinion. It's the only subject I know where if you know something, you're considered biased. If you don't know anything, that's the viewpoint you want. This is roughly the same as suggesting that if somebody's concerned about open heart surgery, ask their neighborhood plumber for advice, not the open heart surgeon because he's biased. That's a strange way of looking at it. Anyway, the point is, none of this 11-man committee was a believer. They studied the phenomenon for 3 years. They wrote the Condon Report, a bunch of other stuff. Very, very quietly published their findings in a technical journal. No one had that. They noted that careful study of this report reveals that 30% of the 117 cases studied in detail could not be identified. Quote, the opposite conclusions from Dr. Condon's could have been drawn from the content of the report, namely that a phenomenon with such a high ratio of unexplained cases, 30%, should arouse sufficient scientific curiosity to continue its study, unquote. And the reason that careful study was required to find that 30% is that, believe it or not, the book was that tightly, almost 1,000 pages, originally in one chapter, not one, devoted to unidentified phenomena. Now, how in the world can you study a phenomenon like this without throwing out the cases you can identify, which you decide the ones that you don't have enough data for, and focusing almost all your attention on what's left? I don't know. Somehow they managed to do it, which is one of the reasons I don't consider this a very scientific study. I'll give you one sighting out of the Condon report, again for flavoring purpose, we can turn to contention. This is another radar visual case. It took place late in the evening. This separate Air Force ground-based radar installation picked up this crazily behaving object in the sky. I say crazily behaving because what it would do is it would sit there at a few thousand feet altitude, plainly oval at this time. And it would suddenly zip off at 600 miles an hour. It always moves all right, it's suddenly going 600 miles an hour. Fly 8 or 9 miles and stop dead. No visible deceleration. Sit there, zip off in a different direction, 600 miles an hour. Stop, and zigzag around in the sky. Now, the two ground-based radar installations talk to each other on the radio, you know, do you see what I see? They each send somebody outside to look. They agree that, yeah, there really is something out there behaving in this crazy fashion. We don't have anything like this. Let's scramble the jet and see what's going on. They scramble it. They haven't invented an aircraft. They talk to the pilot on the radio. They don't know what he's doing. He says, I have a visual confirmation of the unknown. He sees it. Next thing he says on the radio is, I've got a radar lock guy. That means his guns are ready to fly, have fire. Nice friendly fellows, we heard from Zara. Shoot first, ask questions later. And he later says, I saw an airborne target he's ever seen. The next thing he says around the screen, he says, hey, where'd it go? Guy on the ground says, just circle around behind you. Looks back and sure enough, scared the heck out of him. Spends the next 8 or 9 minutes going through all kinds of high-speed maneuvers trying to get away from the UFO that sticks to him like glue. All this is being observed by the radar operators, two separate blips on the screen. Finally, the guy runs out of gas, he lands, the UFO takes off. Now look what we have. Three separate sets of eyes, two on the ground, one in the air. Three separate radar sets, two on the ground, one in the air. Anybody who says that that's an optical illusion doesn't understand optics. We also have in this instance behavior that you have to say is intelligently controlled. You can't go from in front of a high-performance, high-speed aircraft to behind it and stick with it for fancy maneuvers. If you're a meteor or a balloon or a bird or anything like that. Now, we didn't have anything to do that back in the 1930s. That's one of many unknowns in the Condon Report. Now, one of their knowns I'll have to give to you because this is such a beautiful explanation and bears repeating. One sighting they eventually identified as probably a natural phenomena so rare it had never been observed before or since. That's a strange way of looking at it. Okay, let me continue my little polling effort, then I'm going to ask a rhetorical question. How many people here have read the UFO evidence in my time? Okay, would you raise your hand if you have? One. Two, sorry. I'm a member of NICAP, NICAP didn't run. How many have read the Congressional Hearings Doctrine? Would you raise your hand? One. Okay, how many have read Dr. Hynek's book? One. Is there any bookstores in this? How many have read the Condon Report? That's usually the most popular one by far. One, two, three. Four, five, I think there was another one back, at least six, seven, wow. Okay, the rhetorical question I'll ask at this point is, without my regaling you with sightings, and you can read INF 70 or McDonald's 40 or NICAP 700, and without you having seen the pictures yet, but the goal is there. How come the big wheels of science, politics, and the news media haven't jumped on the pro-UFO bandwagon, which they obviously have? Now, I don't mean to imply that most people don't believe in UFOs. That would be a false interpretation. As a matter of fact, the Gallup poll just 4 months ago showed that a majority of Americans do believe in UFOs. Further, the greater the education, more likely to believe in UFOs. A poll of engineers and scientists a couple years back showed that a majority of them believe that UFOs were real. But it's a silent majority. And sort of the Condonian Menzelian viewpoint is very much a minority viewpoint. But quite obviously, the big shots of science, media, and politics haven't jumped on the UFO bandwagon. The question is why? I think there are four reasons. I think these are worth looking at because I think they apply to some other areas which also don't receive the attention they deserve from the professionals. The first reason is ignorance, not stupidity. Simply lack of awareness of the data. I have consistently found that the loudest anti-UFO noises come from the professionals who know the least about the subject. I happen to feel that one is expressing an opinion from a publicly appointed pedestal, that one has an obligation to that public, as a professional, to either know where of one speaks or to shut up. It's as simple as that. Everybody can tell that private opinions, of course. You're going to speak as a professional because some newsman says, Dr. So-and-so, what do you think about this? You either should preface your remarks with, look, I don't know anything about it, so you can judge it, or say, simply, I don't know anything about it, I won't say anything. The first problem is ignorance, lack of awareness of the data. The second problem is different, it's the laughter curtain, the fear of ridicule that keeps most people from reporting their sightings to people you'd like to see investigated, and from having guts enough to investigate. You see, UFO sightings are really quite common. The St. Gallup poll of November 1973 showed that 15 million Americans, 11% of the adult population, believed that they had seen a UFO. That number was only 5 million in 1966. The poll of engineers and scientists that shows the majority of them believe in UFOs shows that 8% believe that they have definitely seen one. Another 14% say maybe. And remember, UFOs are a worldwide phenomenon. Every continent, it's not just the United States at all. Many of my curtain sightings, too. I check all my audiences around the country. I ask how many people have seen a UFO after my lecture. We know I'm not. I consistently find anywhere from 4 to 15% believe that they have seen it. But when I ask how many of you reported what you saw, I'm lucky 10% of those who have seen it. When I ask privately, you know, gee, that sounded like a good case, why don't you report it? The answer I most often hear is, they think I was some kind of a nut. I think it's time we lifted the laughter curve. The subject is much too important to be left in the hands of the cartoonists and comedians. And fortunately, there's some progress being made. Three PhD theses have been completed on the subject of UFOs, various subjects. Another one is in progress. There have been technical meetings, scientific meetings, the only professionals involved giving papers on UFOs. We're making a certain amount of progress. It's slow, but we're Okay. Now, ignorance, whatever you've heard. The third problem of playing amateur psychiatrist, and it's ego. E-G-O. If blind places are real and coming here and not talking to talk to us, that makes some of us feel a lot less important than we'd like them to be on. Dr. Mendel has publicly stated, if aliens were visiting this planet, they would of course wish to talk to the members of the National Academy of Sciences, which includes him and Dr. Carlin. His whole attitude has been, they haven't asked for their appointment, obviously they're not coming here. I've talked to a couple of news directors who've taken a similar view. They say, if aliens were coming to this planet, they'd call the news conference and we'd have been involved. I don't really think any of these guys think they're worth talking to. How many school did I just talk to with fish head? Are we worth talking? The ego problem really goes much deeper. You see, flying saucers actually finished the job that Nicolaus Copernicus, the Polish astronomer, started way back in 1543. Copernicus was born 500 years ago last year, if you want a good anniversary to keep. And in 1523, he wrote a book, a rather upsetting book, a disturbing book. What he said was that the notion which everybody accepted at that time, that the Earth was the center of the universe and stood still, he said, that's not the way it is. The sun is the middle of the universe. The Earth, just like the other stuff out there, goes around the sun. Well, Olney was a pretty sharp cookie. He wouldn't let the book be published for 20 years before he died because he knew it would upset a few people. And boy, was he right. He was lucky he died before it was published. Somebody else got burned at the stake, literally, for agreeing with Copernicus. The high priests of the time were, to say the least, quite upset. You know, a new set of high priests, you know, they were lab coats instead of prayer or sanctity. It took a couple of hundred years, most people got to be convinced that old Nick was right. Sun's the middle of the universe. Telescope wasn't meant to have more electricity. What a good observation. Many of you will probably be amazed to find out that it was only 50 years ago that we realized that Copernicus wasn't right either. Well, the Earth goes around the sun, only no question about that. But the sun the middle of the universe? No way. What we found 50 years ago is that the sun is one of perhaps 150 billion stars. In our little galaxy, the Milky Way, it's only about 100,000 light years across. It's kind of flat, saucer shaped, maybe 2,000 light years thick. And we're 30,000 light years from the middle. We're out the Buddha. And the sun isn't the biggest star, it's not the oldest star, it's not the brightest star. It's not even the smallest, the dimmest, it's not anything in star. There's not a darn thing special about the sun. If that wasn't bad enough, you know, to go around right next to the middle of the universe after the Buddha, we found that there were millions of other galaxies, each of them with billions of stars. Well, that was too much for the egos of the scientists that didn't understand. Had to do something, so they grabbed the last rung of the ego ladder and they said, okay, it's better than anything special, but this is the only solar system, the only group of planets in the whole galaxy. Why did they say something like that? They said, because the way the planets were produced is that two stars came just the right distance from each other, near collision, tore out parts of one, made the planets. Never happened anyplace else like that happened here. Here we are, up to the objects. And that's the viewpoint that was taught to people perfectly straightforwardly from about 1924 to 1948. And that helps explain, incidentally, why in that Gallup poll, the older the individual was, the less likely it is to believe there's any other life out there. The older the individual, quite naturally, the less likely it is to believe that UFOs are real. It goes against what he was taught by experts, so called. There's one more part to the ego bit. We always seem to be saving our ego, incidentally, we realized in 1950 that that's not how the planets were formed. Planetary formation is a natural part of the development of many star systems. In our own little galaxy, there's probably only a few billion planets. The other part of the ego thing is that some professors would have to admit that for 25 years they had loads of graduate students, plenty of research funds, and that's not a darn thing about the UFO. It's easier to say that they don't exist than to say that they need something important. Now, if you're playing amateur psychiatrist, now I'll play professional scientist, technologist, if you will. The fourth problem is this. It's an almost complete failure to use our knowledge of technology to try to understand UFO behavior. I stress this one because almost all the early arguments by professionals against the existence of UFOs were along the lines that what people claim to have observed is obviously impossible. So they couldn't have observed it. There's a whole long list of impossibles. One scientist proved mathematically you can't go 10,000 miles an hour in the atmosphere without putting it. Proved it absolutely. That particular argument is infinity. Everybody knows our entire space and defense program is based on being able to go much faster than 10,000 miles an hour in the atmosphere without putting up. When the Apollo astronauts come back from the moon in the command module, they hit the atmosphere 25,000 miles an hour. And they come down untoasted, too. And we and the Russians play games with intercontinental ballistic missiles. They hit a peak velocity of around 15,000 miles an hour, and they come down untoasted as well. The important point here, of course, is that we don't solve this particular technical problem, high heating and high speed flight in the atmosphere, the way the guy who proved it was impossible tried to solve it. What he should have said was, the method I've tried doesn't work. Or, let's try something else. Or let's study UFOs and figure out what they're doing that we don't know how to do. He ignored a basic aspect of technological development. That is that technological progress almost invariably comes from doing things differently in an unpredictable way. It's not just more of the same way we've been doing things before. We'll come back to this a little bit. Along the lines of it's impossible, another one of the arguments made was that if you were to go real fast in the atmosphere, you certainly wouldn't build something that was round and blunt, like the reports of UFOs seem to indicate they were. No, that's not the way a high-speed plane's going to look. Of course not. It's got a pointy nose, sharp wings, highly streamlined. Right? Wrong. Our fastest manned craft to fly in the atmosphere is at Apollo command module. You know what it looks like? It's round and blunt. It has no wings, no tail, no visible external engines. I sit next to a couple of them, you know, it's fine. And nothing at all is like our old ideas of high-speed aircraft would look like. There's a whole long list of it's impossible. Almost everything we've ever done, this previous generations proved was impossible. We'll skip all of these except one. Because this particular argument is still being made. Over and over again, it's wrong every time. But you'll hear it, it's been heard on the Jenny Carson Show, the Cabot Show, Time Magazine, all kinds of things. This argument, usually made by astronomers and exobiologists, that is, people concerned with extraterrestrial life, goes like this. They say, look, we know that there's nothing special about the sun or the earth or even intelligent creatures. We think there's life all over the place out there. Some of that life's more advanced than we are, but you can't get here from there. So give us a few bucks and we'll build a huge radio telescope and the signals from outer space. Because obviously they've got a beacon and they're sending signals waiting for us to answer so we can join the Galactic Federation. I don't think we qualify for membership myself. And I've got a few bucks, that's a slight understatement, the biggest study done for NASA, proposing we build Project Cyclops. 10-mile-wide array of radio telescopes. Total cost, $6 to $10 billion. Our money. I have to think if under $1 million I can find out all you ever want to know about UFOs. Rather than spending $10 billion to find out what kind of radio commercial they're sending out from Alpha Centauri, which is about a week from that. Now, you say you can't get here from there. Dr. Carl Sagan on the Tonight Show, the Cabot Show, talked in terms of the Pioneer 10 spacecraft, you know, the one that went by Jupiter, and said that it's the fastest craft we've got. At its highest velocity, it would take 80,000 years to get to the next nearest star if it was headed in the right direction, which it isn't. Obviously, interstellar travel is not to be considered. Is that reasonable? It's totally unreasonable. Here is the particular thing. To think of Pioneer 10 as an interstellar spacecraft, my word, makes about as much sense as comparing a skateboard and a Saturn V rocket. The Pioneer 10's been coasting since it left the vicinity of the Earth. No propulsion system at all to push it out there. It found a little steeper hill when it went by Jupiter to double its velocity. It is in no way, shape, or form an interstellar spacecraft. Any more than a bow point to the ocean is an ocean carrying or crossing ship. gets to the same medium, but hardly at the same rate.
Huh? Any of that here from there, or they're not?
There are a whole bunch of studies that prove it's absolutely impossible. We will, of course, ignore those. Let's see what Dr. Condon has to say. Remember the National Academy of Sciences, all kinds of other fancy honors? Page 27, I'm quote. Travel of men, and presumably women, over interstellar, that is between the stars' distances, in the foreseeable future, seems now to be quite out of the question. Unquote. That took care of us. The next page 28, takes care of that. This is a gym. We consider that it is safe to assume that no intelligent life outside of our solar system has any possibility of visiting Earth in the next 10,000 years. An utterly incredible statement, except if one possibility. If Dr. Condon had talked to the chief scheduling agent for the intragalactic transportation system and been told, Ed, we don't have anything scheduled your way for the next 10,000 years. I've talked to Dr. Condon, he hasn't talked to the chief scheduling agent. Well, can you get here from there or not? We'll ignore the negative studies. There's several that come to quite different conclusions. Let me tell you just about one of these. This is a paper published 11 years ago by Dwayne Spencer and Leonard Jaffe of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory at the California Institute of Technology in Pasadena, California. Now, JPL's business is space hardware. You know, the Ranger program, the Surveyor program, the Mariner program, the Pioneer program, it's all one. They build them, put them up, test them, run them. That's their business. Not the business of astronomers, and so they have nothing to do with propulsion systems. Anyway, they published a paper entitled The Feasibility of Interstellar Travel. The question they asked was this. They said, is it feasible with the knowledge we have today, and without violating any laws of physics, it's feasible for us to consider trips to nearby stars and expect to have a round trip time short of the average person's lifespan? Before I answer your question, let's get one aspect of this quite straight. We are talking about nearby stars. The nearest star to the sun is about 5 light years away. Within 40 light years, a couple hundred star systems. We are not concerned with trips across the galaxy, you know, 80,000 light years that way, 2,000 light years that way. No, that's not what we're concerned with. We're obviously not concerned with trips to other galaxies, the Andromeda galaxy, the next nearest big one, only 2 million light years away. That's not what we're talking about. We're certainly not concerned with trips to the outer limits of the universe. It's like 10 or 15 billion light years away. We're talking about local travel. You know, across the street, next door, down the street. That's a very, very different problem from travel to other galaxies. Now, I stress this because I have frequently been misquoted as saying, you said we could get to other galaxies. That's not what we're talking about. Okay, the answer to the question, very straightforward. It is indeed feasible with the knowledge we have today, and without violating any of the laws of physics, to consider trips to nearby stars and expect to have the round trip time be shorter than 60 years. You say, what kind of crazy assumptions did those guys make? Fourth dimensional space time warp? Sounds great, but no. Anti-gravity, maybe. That sounds good too, but no. How about matter-antimatter annihilation? Another good one, but no. I'm not saying any of those three are impossible. I'm saying they may be science fiction, might be science They make two important assumptions. The first was that we use stage rockets. That doesn't mean a rocket is put up on a stage. You know, it means a big first stage on a pod, second stage. There's a someplace way up there, a payload. So of course we're going to use stage rockets. All our manned launches are stage rockets. Yeah, we know that, but all the early studies assumed single stage rockets launched directly from the surface of the Earth. It quite easily proved that you can't get to the moon that way, or even a Saturn V rocket. In other words, nobody in its right mind would do it that way. the first assumption would be obvious in retrospect. And the second one isn't so obvious, and that is that the space rockets beat fission or fusion propulsion systems. And some wise guys have just done this. Fission or fusion adds A bonds of H bonds. It's a crazy way to say it. It's not really what we're talking about. Yes, it's the same process. Let's deal with fission first. Fission is the process that goes on in nuclear reactors. I think they're building one over in Berwick or someplace not far from here. Pennsylvania has a number of nuclear power reactors. One of the earliest over at near Pittsburgh Shippingport. And around the world there are dozens of nuclear power reactors, every once in a while generating some electrical power. There are also some nuclear fission propulsion systems around. The nuclear Navy has a number of, last time I heard, something over 100 nuclear submarines zipping around under the water, chasing the Russian nuclear submarines that are zipping around under the water. You say, hey, look, obviously you can't get to the stars on nuclear submarines. No water out there. That's true, but fortunately for my story, the agency and NASA, with your money, for 15 years supported the development of nuclear rocket reactor propulsion systems, fission systems. The Rover program, the NERDER program, I spent 2 years of my life at Westinghouse over near Pittsburgh working on the development of nuclear rocket reactor propulsion systems. Now, we didn't just talk about them, we built them. We tested them, too. In December 1967, we successfully tested the NRX A6 nuclear rocket reactor propulsion system. It was this big, 3D planned. Power level of that little monster was 1,100 million watts. That's half the power of Grand Coulee Dam in the once in a while comparison. We were rather pleased with the results of the test. But 7 months later, Los Alamos Scientific Laboratory, way out of this, they successfully tested the Phoebus 2B reactor. It was this big, 4.5 feet in diameter. Power level of that, Jim. 4,400 million watts. That's twice the power of a Grand Coulee Dam, something this big. Give that program a billion or $2. 10 years, we'll have man-made nuclear fission propulsion systems for spacecraft. This is hardware. These aren't figments of freak imagination. They're real. You paid for them, too. Even if nobody calls them patents. That's fission. I'm really much more excited by a much more efficient rocket system, fusion. Now, I spent a year of my life working on fusion propulsion systems. We did not successfully test hardware. We only spent, something around $4 billion. Give that program 50 billion, 30 years, we'll have man-rated, flight-ready fusion propulsion systems for space travel. Very efficient rocket. Probably wondering what the heck fusion is. It is what goes on in H-bonds. It's also, whether you realize it or not, the most important, by far, source of energy in your lives. The sun up there is a fusion factory. It is not a mass of burning gas. There's no standard oil up there, no IRX. It's a fusion factory. Now, fusion rockets are rather attractive. Say, what's the big deal about fusion? Two big deals, actually. To use the right isotopes in the right way, you can kick particles out the back end of a rocket that have 10 million times as much energy per particle as they can get in a chemical rocket. In other words, on a miles per gallon basis, fusion is definitely the way to go. Now the other nice thing is that the stuff you use happens to be isotopes of hydrogen and helium. And helium just, and hydrogen just happen to be the two most light, the lightest substances, and most abundant substances in the whole universe. Any other system you go to for a weekend vacation, the gas station may be closed on Sunday, but there'll be plenty of hydrogen and helium. That's kind of handy. Now at this point I better tell you that I don't think you have to work by either fission or fusion to get here from other star systems because I've left something extremely important out of the discussion. Probably wondering why the heck did I mention fission and fusion when I don't think they work that way. Two reasons. There are at least 4 published papers that show you can do it that way. And secondly, because some people get very angry at me if I can't explain every crazy aspect of UFO behavior. Now that's rather peculiar. Whether I can explain it or not doesn't make it real. It's real.
even if my chemists know. The sun was fusioning for almost 5 billion years before it figured out 1938 what made it work. You're going to tell me it wasn't just fusioning before that? Because we didn't know what fusioning was? That's ridiculous. Now, the thing I've left out of the discussion is cosmic time. At 5 billion years, if the sun has been put in white, there really is 4.6, but we can move on. You say, what in the world has cosmic time got to do with anything? Well, simply this. We've had sophisticated technology, radio waves, that sort of thing, for 100 years, which isn't a very big percentage of 5 billion year history of the solar system. And yet, in that 100 years, we've increased our top speed for people 1,000 times over. This would go 1,000 times faster than space than just 100 years ago. Now, we can do that by breeding bigger horses or building better sailboats or anything like that. By technology, building on technology, building on technology. Technological progress has come from doing things differently in an unpredictable way. You're probably still wondering, what's that got to do with this whole business? Well, let us suppose that some thinking creatures, I almost said some other thinking creatures, they're judging about us, that some thinking creatures somewhere in us got started on their technological kit. Before we did. Well, what's a tiny bit out of 5 billion? Surely it could be 100 years. It's the wink of an eye, 5 billion. Well, they got started just 100 years before we did. You might quite conservatively estimate that they could go at least 1,000 times faster than we can, using techniques about which we know nothing. Well, let's be honest, they could just as well have started 1,000 years before we did. There's nothing special about 1,000 out of 5 billion. You could just as well have been 10,000, 100,000, 1 million years out of the thing. That's still a small fraction. And when I tell you that the astronomers tell us that there are stars at least 5 billion years older than the sun, you begin to understand why I think that we're the Johnny Comelites of the system. That intelligent critters have been traipsing around between the stars for eons. And who in his right mind is going to tell us that he knows what the technology of 100 years from now will be? No less 1,000 or 1,000,000 or 1,000,000,000. Because technological progress comes from doing things differently in an unpredictable way. Now that's not just a slogan. Yes, that worked for General Electric, and yes, progress was our most important product, but it's really the way it is. A couple of examples. Lasers and light bulbs are both sources of light. A laser isn't just a better light bulb. It requires entirely new and different physics, new knowledge of physical principles. And when Edison finished inventing a light bulb, he didn't say, thank God, that's done, now I'll build me a laser. He wasn't on the horizon. He wasn't coming. The same thing goes with these little tiny micro circuits, you know, the ones that fit on the head of a pin and make these little pocket calculators feasible. They really do the same things that big old fat vacuum tubes do. They're not just tiny vacuum tubes. They work by entirely different physical principles. The guys who built the vacuum tubes weren't predicting that next year we'll be building microcircuits. And finally, fission and fusion propulsion systems of the type I discussed, actually almost all of the fission systems, are used to replace furnaces. But they're not just better furnaces. You don't make water, make steam, turn a turbine. They require entirely new physics and knowledge that the furnace builders don't need. So we summarize this technological excursion. In the first place, trips to the stars are already cheesy. It's a political choice. We want to spend the dough. Like getting to the moon 35 years ago, we knew how to do it. It took a heck of a lot of effort. Secondly, we see that we have to expect that if we survive any length of time, there will be new knowledge, new technology about which we presently know nothing. By cosmic time scale, surely we would be considered retarded. Maybe on a local time scale, I'm not so sure. Thirdly, I will state without backing up that UFOs don't violate the laws of physics. There's a physicist that understands the laws of physics and it's a practical spread. That's a separate one. Now, there's one more thing to deal with before we jump over to the nitty gritty, you know, the landings, the critters, all that sort of stuff. Some people object to UFOs on sort of strange grounds, the astronomers in particular. They say, if somebody was coming here, he wouldn't act the way these things supposedly act. Now, So I would submit to you that astronomers are about the least likely guys to go to for any notions about the motivation of Earthlings, no less mixed expressions. But they raise such questions as one guy raised, and he says, why would UFOs land behind those dormitories up in Michigan? As it were, some such science. You know, as if they were Martian peeping toms and the girls had something to do with their beach. And another one asked me, why would they sit over swamps where they could visit Paris? I don't know how to answer that because I haven't been to Paris yet myself. But I don't think their behavior is so strange or peculiar or unusual, and I don't think you will either. If you take a new perspective, look at things in a different way. Let's start by changing the name. UFO isn't a very descriptive term after all. The best sighting, instead of calling them UFOs, let's call them EENs. Say, what the heck's an EEN? Earth Excursion Module. Just like our lunar excursion module.